Hello again, this is Christian Hunter with the program we call A Time for Prayer. Thank you for being there with me, adding your faith to mine as we go into the presence of God to worship, to praise, to glorify His holy name, and at the same time to bring our prayer petitions before Him, because He is faithful and He's invited us to come freely into His courts with thanksgiving, into His presence with praise. And so we do. Father, in the name of Jesus, we come into Your presence so grateful, so thankful for this invitation to come boldly. Lord, You're wonderful to us. Your blessings, Your goodness, Your kindness, Your grace and Your mercy are so wonderful. Thank You, Lord, that You have considered us, that You have condescended to us to bring us into Your presence, to bless us with Your presence, and also You have given us an understanding of how that we may come into Your presence and be a blessing to You. And what a joy it is to be in Your presence with all of these friends that are part of the kingdom of God, adding faith to faith, prayer to prayer, praise to praise, and the wonderful presence of Almighty God. Our gracious Heavenly Father, how grateful we are to be the children of God. So grateful, Lord, that You have chosen us, because we didn't choose You, but You searched us out, You sought us out, and You chose us that we should come before You. You chose us and ordained us that we should bring forth fruit. And You said, Lord Jesus, You said that herein is our Heavenly Father glorified, that we bear much fruit. And that is our prayer today, Lord, that we indeed would bear much fruit, the fruit of praise, the fruit of worship, the fruit of adoration, and that You would be pleased. And for this purpose, O Lord, we ask that You would anoint us.
Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king, but in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls, because Well, we have with us this evening Pastor David Whitley from the Institute of the Constitution, and we're going to be talking about the Constitution of the United States. And some people may say, well, why worry about the Constitution? That was a long time ago, and yet people really don't understand that the reason America is different than any other nation in the world is not because of our purple mountains, majesties, or our fields of waving grain, or our oceans on either side, or our race of people, because we're not a race of people. We're really made up of a melting pot of people from not only Europe, but from all over the world. And you can be from Asia, and you can be a good American. You can be from south of the border, and a Mexican or South American. You can be a good American. You can be from Africa. You can be a good American. But the one thing that binds all Americans together is a unique heritage of freedom based upon our Constitution. We are the only nation in the history of mankind that acknowledged that freedom comes from God. And it was because of that acknowledgement in the Declaration of Independence that governments were instituted among men, deriving their just authority from the consent of the governed. That's what it says in the Declaration of Independence. And out of the Declaration and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and of course the Federalist Papers, which explains what this was all about, came a unique experiment in self-government. What was self-government? It meant that you limited the power of government and people governed themselves rather than have an all-powerful government. For as William Penn had said so well, those who will not be ruled by God will be ruled by tyrants. And who really believes that the American people are ruled by God today and look to God for what they do? We started as a Christian nation, made predominantly of Christians, and evolved into a atheist nation, and now we've become a pagan nation. And I fear for my people when I reflect that God is just, and his justice will not sleep forever. Well, that is the background. Pastor David Whitney, good to have you with us again.
So great to be on your show, Dr. Stan. I know that the people who listen to your show are people who are very interested to discover the roots of our understanding of what form of government our forefathers gave to us, because obviously what is taking place today, the people in power today, they do not believe what our forefathers believed. They do not hold to the same principles that our founders held to, and there is a way to restore the republic, and that's why we're on your program, and that's why we're helping people across the country learn these principles. You know, James Madison, who is rightly called the father of our Constitution, he had a major influence in shaping every element of the Constitution. He was writing in the National Gazette January 19th in 1792, and he said, "Every word of the Constitution decides a question between power and liberty." And that principle needs to be understood, that we need to study and understand every single phrase and word of the Constitution, what it originally meant according to the founders, those who framed it and drafted it and then ratified it.
I agree with you, and that's so important that the message that you have at the Institute of the Constitution gets out. Because if the American people don't understand the foundations of our freedom, then we will not be able to preserve it. And of course, what David and the other people at the Institute do is to give you the wherewithal to begin to teach the Constitution and its history and its meaning in your community and all across America today. Institutes are being set up, and people are once again beginning to learn this wonderful history of what made us a free people. Well, David, go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, let's start with the preamble and then look at the specific phrases and discover what they intended. The very first phrase is, "We the people." And this shows that our founders believed and understood that government is derived from the consent of the governed. That is, you and I, as the people, the citizens of this land, the governing powers cannot do anything that we have not granted them the power to do. You see, our founders understood that rights, as you said earlier, rights come from God. God gives rights to people. Governments don't have any rights. It's people, we the people, given our God-given rights, we the people then grant powers to the government that we have formed. We, the people, formed the government, and it was our consent that the government came into existence, and the government continues in existence. And this is a far cry from what I'm afraid most people believe today. They believe that government is, by its own power and its own authority existing, and it derives nothing from we the people. And basically, the government can choose to do whatever it chooses to do because it is the government. It's as if the government is a self-authenticating being, an entity that doesn't derive its powers from anyone. This is the opposite of what our founders believed, and part of the reason why our government today is so tyrannical and able to get away with such abuses of power on both the federal level as well as the state level and even local levels. That abuse of power is taking place because the people have laid down their rights and said, okay, we'll let the government walk over us, and we're not going to lift a finger to do anything about it because, well, they can do whatever they choose. So the idea in the mind of our founders of what government is about is 180 degrees apart from where most Americans are today, and we hope to wake up the sleeping giant Americans that will recognize that government only has powers that we the people have agreed that government would have, and that agreement is our Constitution, which is, again, why it's so important to understand every phrase of the Constitution so that you are able to hold your government accountable to the terms of this Constitution that we have.
And I think it's what's so important is that the very essence of our liberty was limiting the power of the federal government. The federal government was to have nothing to do with the individual, have nothing to do with their life, liberty, or the pursuit of, or their property. All of those rights were to be managed by the states. And that's what the 45th of the Federalist Papers says. The power of the central government was to be limited and defined. The power of the state was to be unlimited and ill-defined. Why? Because anything having to do with the individual is to be taking place there, not at the federal level. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Pastor Whitney was beginning to talk about the meaning of the preamble to the Constitution and the careful selection of words, each word having a specific meaning, not to be interpreted any way that the Supreme Court wants, but as it was originally interpreted, and that's the job of the Supreme Court, not to change the Constitution, which they've sworn to uphold. Because once they begin to change the Constitution and go to other countries to figure out what our laws should be, then they become enemies of the state. They become terrorists by the very definition of the Patriot Act, which says anybody who wants to change our form of government is a terrorist. And an awful lot of them are wearing black robes in Washington, D.C. today. So pick the story up, David.
That's right. Well, that phrase, we the people, which the Constitution begins with, also shows that the framers viewed government as a covenant. That is, we the people have entered into a covenant formed with our civil government. We created the civil government. It did not exist before the Constitution. It was created, this federal government was created by the Constitution, by we the people entering a covenantal relationship. And the covenants all hark back to the biblical covenants. You have God forming a covenant with Adam and Eve and with Noah and Moses and Abraham, and on down through the Old Testament, covenants are formed between God and his people. The idea is that the government is not independent. The government is in an agreement, and the government is required to meet the terms of that agreement. Read through the Old Testament, you'll find again and again the people of Israel violated the terms of their covenant with God time after time, and God punished them time after time after time for their violation of that covenant. Well, you know, God has an ability that no human being does to punish the evildoers. But we, the people, in this covenant relationship with our government, we have a power to check an abuse of government, a government that refuses to abide by the terms of our covenant. We can vote them out of office. We can remove them from office by impeachment, or if they are not on good behavior, they can be removed from office. So there's a number of checks that we have against a government that violates the covenant that we have entered in. But again, most Americans don't understand this, and most Americans therefore don't understand that their task, their duty as a citizen, is to understand the terms of this covenant, understand the Constitution, so that they're able to hold their elected officials accountable to the terms of that Constitution.
And I think that's what's so important. Once you understand that your elected congressman is violating the oath he is sworn to uphold the Constitution, then you not only have an obligation to let him know, but let everybody else know and get rid of that congressmen. There are only a very, very few congressmen that really adhere to the Constitution when they make their decision. It makes it a lot easier when a spending bill comes up. Whether you should vote for it or against it, you simply should ask, is it constitutional? When a legislation comes up having to do with education, is it a good idea, is it a bad idea? Or is it a constitutional idea? Does the federal government have any say in education, which it does not? And that's why when you look at the voting record of somebody like Congressman Ron Paul, he always gets 100%. Why? He simply votes by the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And you will find very few, probably not more than one or two other congressmen in the United States House of Representatives today that are true to their oath to defend America against all enemies, both foreign and domestic, because many of the people who sit in the House of Representatives today are enemies of the Constitution and do not abide by its very clear and concise rules.
We understand basically that although we as citizens, if we were born here in this country, we do not aren't required to take an oath unless we are an elected official or unless we serve in the military or so on, we ought to understand that it is our duty to protect this country against domestic enemies as well as foreign enemies. And those domestic enemies, as you say, are many people in power in Washington, D.C., as well as in state capitals all over this land. Well, following that phrase, we the people, they set forth six basic purposes for which the government they were forming by the Constitution was to be brought into existence. The first is to form a more perfect union. In order to form a more perfect union, you see, during the era between the Declaration and the Constitution, the reigning document was the Articles of Confederation, which we've spoken of before, and there was many problems with that, one of which was disunity among the 13 states. States treating one another as foreign nations, treating the citizens of another state when they're traveling or residing in another state as if they were foreigners without any rights and so on. So there's a number of things going on where the disunity between the 13 states was very destructive, they wanted to form a more perfect union through the Constitution, correcting some of the problems that were obvious from the Articles of Confederation. The second purpose that they set forth was to establish justice, to provide an orderly and fair court system. And what we need to remember here is that there is a standard of justice. It's not a flexible, it's not a living, breathing standard, it is a fixed standard that they were speaking of, and the whole purpose of the Constitution is to establish this fixed standard of justice. What was their fixed standard of justice? What did they have in mind? They had very clearly in mind what they stated in the Declaration of Independence. When you ask our founders, you know, what is the purpose of government? It's to secure our God-given rights. And how do we know what they are? Well, we know that from the laws of nature and nature's God. And as we talked about before, those two phrases, the laws of nature, refers to human conscience that God has written on the heart of every human being. Every human being, no matter where they are in the world, he's written his law on their conscience. Whether they acknowledge it or obey it is a different thing, but you could parachute into any part of the world and the first human being you met, if you grabbed something that they had in their hands and began running as fast as you could, what would happen? That person, no matter what their language or culture, background, anything, they would come running after you because they know the law of God that says, thou shalt not steal. It's written on their hearts, and they know that. So that's the first phrase. The second phrase, the laws of nature's God, we know is the Bible. We know that because they were reading William Blackstone, as we've said before, and Blackstone clearly established that God's revealed law, the Bible, is the absolute law. So this, when you ask, how do you establish justice? Well, you punish injustice. How do you determine what's injustice? You go to the supreme law of the universe, God's law, the Bible, and we know that the English common law, has developed over the centuries, was basically an exposition of those biblical principles. William Blackstone, in his commentaries on the laws of England, pointed out again and again how English common law was an expression and an application of the biblical law found in the Bible.
And I just comment for just a moment. There was a man named John Locke who lived in the 1600s. He was an Englishman. And he wrote extensively about these ideas of freedom. And he wrote about nature's God and nature's law. And of course, that certainly the right to life and liberty and property, those were his phrases. They were Lockonian phrases. And of course, William Blackstone had picked that up, you know, almost a century later and recorded them in the Commentaries on the Laws of England, which was the basis of English law and were the basis of American law for at least 100 years after the Constitution was signed. These are the things that people do not understand. And you read the first paragraph of the Declaration of Independence that talks about nature's God and nature's law. And that everybody at that time understood. They were talking about the Bible because they'd gone back and they'd read John Locke. They did not dumb down the people and stress mediocrity in the schools, you know, 300 years ago. They stressed excellence. They stressed trying to teach people history and trying to understand what had happened in the past so we wouldn't make the same mistakes again. And our founding fathers had all read John Locke, and they'd read, of course, the history of what had happened to Greece and ancient Rome and other civilizations before. And they understood that the foundation of law in America, as it had been in England, would be based upon the Bible, nature's God, nature's law.
And that should be a great encouragement to anyone who is a Christian. You know, we were told today again and again that, you know, our founders were secularists and they were seeking to establish some secular government. That is a lie, a flat-out lie. And it can be proven with the historic facts. It's not difficult to disprove that lie. But as Christians, we need to study the Bible. We need to study the Bible so we know what God's law is and understand that what is just in America, what is just in America, according to our founders, is what is in concert with, agreement with, God's law. So as we study our Bible, we are preparing to function and to serve as Christian citizens, because we've got to hold our elected officials accountable to the supreme law of the universe, God's law. That's the standard of justice that they were speaking of when they said, we the people, in order to establish justice. A fixed standard, as we said before, not a changing standard, because God's law 4,000 years ago is the same as it is today. It did not change one iota. Thou shalt not steal is thou shalt not steal, and it applies to everyone. Even that Supreme Court justices that said, oh, yeah, we give the government of New London, Connecticut the permission to steal property from the people of New London, Connecticut. God's law is still the same. They're the one breaking God's law, and we need to hold them accountable for their violation of God's law and the supreme law of our land. Well, the third purpose that they set forth as the purpose for which this Constitution was ratified was to ensure domestic tranquility. There was a number of insurrections that took place during the Articles of Confederation era, things like Shays' Rebellion and so on, and there was difficulty in dealing with those because of aspects of the Articles of Confederation that presented weaknesses in the form of government structured. And so they wanted to ensure domestic tranquility by dealing with those domestically who were enemies of we the people, enemies of good government. And as you mentioned, we have the enemies of good government running the government in our day, and so we're in dire shape, and we really need to ensure domestic tranquility against these enemies.
And we need to understand that each one of those terms, whether it be form, establish, you know, maintain, and then, of course, the next word would be promote. And then the next word would be provide. And, of course, promote the provide for the common defense, but promote the general welfare. You would never provide for the general welfare in a free society, because any government that can provide whatever you need, you've got to be able to take whatever you have. Well, David, pick the story up there.
Yes, and as you said, provide for the common defense. So the third aspect is basically to defend us against domestic uprising, protect us from people who are traitors within our own camp that would seek to undermine our security and undermine justice. We need to also provide for the common defense, and this, of course, meant raising an army when it was necessary to do so. When we later on look at the details of that, we'll see that a standing army was not their design, not their desire, because a standing army is a danger to liberty of we the people. But we know that they had difficulties during the American War for Independence in maintaining an army, providing bullets and weapons and guns and just providing the basic needs of clothing and food for the soldiers. And they had a terrible time. I mean, the fact that we were able to win the war is only by God's grace. Certainly Congress and their inability to raise funds was a great difficulty. And so one of the biggest reasons why the Constitutional Convention was called was to deal with the issue of how do we provide for the common defense in a way that is fair to all of the 13 states. And as you said, it's not to provide for the general welfare, it's to promote the general welfare. Not the specific welfare of any individual, but the welfare of the entire country. Not the specific welfare of a section of the country or of a certain socioeconomic group or a certain age group. I mean, there's hundreds of examples today of what the federal government is doing that violates this basic principle. It's not, its job is not to be the nanny of the whole country. It's not to be the welfare queen that provides for the food and housing and clothing for people. No, that's not at all what the general welfare, and it was to promote the general welfare was one of the purposes for forming this new structure of government. And then lastly, the sixth reason is to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Now, when you hear the term blessings, you don't think in the context of secular humanism, because in secular humanism, there's no such thing as a blessing, because a blessing comes from God. The people who want to tell us that the Constitution was a secular document by people who were, you know, either semi-Christians or deists, that's a lie, and the historic facts prove that to be a lie. But here, very clearly, they're talking about the blessings that God, who is the author of liberty, gives to us. You look at the Liberty Bell there in Philadelphia, and engraved on the outer rim there is a quote from Leviticus, "Proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all the inhabitants thereof." That's a biblical idea. Liberty comes from God, and He is the author of liberty. That's exactly what our founders understood. And if we follow God's law, if we obey God's law, we experience liberty individually. So if you obey the law, thou shalt not steal, you have liberty. But if you disobey the law, what results is bondage, what results is slavery, what results is tyranny. When government refuses to obey God's law, when government starts stealing people's property, as it's been doing now for quite some time through eminent domain, and it's getting more bold and brazen in doing that today, what happens is that nobody's property is safe.
What is that old saying? Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty.
Amen.
And, so, of course, this is one of the things that we do not preach now, but we should be teaching
it.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney, and we're simply talking about the relationship between these ideas of liberty and the Bible, and that old adage, you know, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty, and it is really from God that we get our freedom. And if you are not ruled by God, then you are going to be ruled by a tyrant. You're either going to have the Bible or you're going to have bayonets. And when you have a society that is becoming increasingly violent, increasingly chaotic, increasingly immoral, what do you think the solution to that is? Someone once said that when liberty leads to a loss of order, then the demand for order will lead to a loss of liberty. That when liberty leads to a loss of order, then the demand for order will lead to a loss of liberty. And that's exactly what is going to happen in this country as we begin moving into a period of chaos and crisis in this country. And, of course, as people turn away from God. So, at one time, everybody in America knew that the power of the central authority was to be limited because you couldn't trust people with power. It would always be misused. And yet there have always been those who wanted a dictatorship in America. They were here at the time of the formation of our Constitution, and now they're in positions of power in both political parties today. And they know that if the government is be able to provide whichever you need from the cradle to the grave, the government's got to be able to con- control you from the cradle to the grave, and that's what it's all about. They're buying our freedom with our own tax money. Go ahead and pick up the story there, David.
Well, when we understand that the blessings of liberty are not just for ourselves, which they said, you know, in their generation, they wanted the blessings of liberty for themselves, but not just for themselves. They were looking down the corridor of history because they wanted the blessings of liberty for our posterity as well. Posterity, obviously, is all those who are unborn, those who might be in the womb at that moment, as well as those who in the future would be in the womb, the unborn. And so there's a very good reason here why abortion is a violation of the basic fundamental principles of the Constitution of the United States. And if there were honest people in the legislative branch and honest people in the executive who understood the Constitution and the original intent of the Constitution, they would recognize that a ruling, actually it's not a ruling even, it's an opinion. You look at every Supreme Court issue, and it says right at the top of the document, this is an opinion. That's not law. So when people say Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, no, it's not. And we have a Supreme Court justice who just said Roe v. Wade is the settled law of the land. He's lying. That's not the case. The court does not make law at all. It's an opinion that it issued, and when its opinion issues in direct contradiction to the Constitution of the United States, which, as we'll see in Article 4, Section 4, says that the Constitution itself is the supreme law of the land, any law made in violation of the supreme law of the land is null and void. It's no law at all. So, of course, Roe v. Wade, first of all, it's not law because it's an opinion of some judges, and secondly, it's not law even if it was a legislative piece of legislation put forward and passed and then signed by the president. It still wouldn't be law because it's violating the basic principles of our Constitution right here in the very preamble. We do ordain and establish this Constitution to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. So we see here that our framers were fundamentally concerned about liberty. They recognized that under King George III, as well as other English monarchs who acted as tyrants, that liberty was a delicate, precious commodity, one of those things that you had to fight for. They said the only way to preserve liberty is to constantly fight for it. And I believe most Americans today do not understand that, which is why they're sitting back in their lazy boys and not up in arms doing something to preserve the liberty that's being taken from us day by day.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. The president could simply issue an executive order and outlaw abortion tomorrow.
That's right.
The Republican majority in Congress could pass legislation and attach to it an appendage saying, utilizing the authority given to us under Article 3, Section 2 of the Constitution, the Supreme Court nor no federal court can have anything to do with this legislation that outlaws abortion. But you have to really understand why abortion is so wrong, why it's abhorrent to God. The people who have studied the Bible will remember that, you know, when Joshua took Jericho, he was ordered to kill everyone in the town. And he was to kill the men and the women and the children and the animals. And the only person who was to escape was Rahab, who was the who had helped Joshua some time earlier. But the reason God demanded that was because the Canaanites in Jericho sacrificed their children to idols, to Moloch. And that was the unforgivable sin, that God would ultimately destroy that nation. And all those people, the men, the women, the children, would die because of that. And what are we doing here in America? Exactly the same thing. We'll be back in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. Go ahead, David.
Well, that phrase, to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, from the preamble, also shows that our founders intended the Constitution to be a permanent document. They would never have agreed with the idea of a living, breathing Constitution, something that changes anytime you want it to change. And, you know, when I talk to people who talk about this idea and believe in the idea of a living, breathing Constitution, I ask them if they have a mortgage or if they have a credit card, or if they have a bank account, any kind of arrangement or agreement with the bank of any sort, and what would they think of that agreement they have with the bank if, you know, for instance, today they were charged a 5% interest on the money they borrowed, but tomorrow it was 10%, and the day after that it was 35%, and it was 50%. It was whatever the bank wanted it to be.
A living, breathing contract, right.
And they said, oh, no, we'd never permit that. We'd take them to court. And rightly so. They would have violated the contract. And yet, I say, well, wait a minute. That's the same idea that you're saying is permissible on the part of our contract, our covenant, with our civil government. It's supposed to be a fixed, unchanging standard, and if it changes, the result is always tyranny and the loss of liberty. Well, they continue in that preamble to say that they do ordain and establish this Constitution. By the way, that's those Christian terminology there, the idea of ordaining. God is the one who ordains, and he sets out ordinances that are his law. All these phrases really are Christian phrases, that to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America, again demonstrating the covenantal idea of government, that we are entering into a covenant, we the people, informing our civil government. So the preamble states these six purposes. It simply states purposes. It doesn't grant any power to the federal government. We're going to see in the Articles 1 what power is granted specifically to the legislative branch and so on. But the preamble just simply states the purposes. And it's very brief, very few words, because the Declaration of Independence, as we said before, is the philosophy of government. It explains the why of government. And now the Constitution is explaining the how, the nuts and bolts of how that all works. Well, jumping right into the Constitution itself then, Article 1 deals with the legislature. By the way, it's very easy to remember the structure of the first half of the Constitution. Article 1 deals with the legislative branch, Article 2 deals with the executive branch, and then Article 3 with the judiciary. So if you're looking for information about the executive branch, you look at Article 2, the judicial, and Article 3. Or
hold that thought right there. We'll be back here in just a moment with Pastor David Whitney. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and before we go on, David, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get in touch with the Institute of the Constitution. I should mention that the Institute of the Constitution does support my ministry, and of course we support their ministry because we think this is really such a very, very important issue. But how can people get in touch with your organization and begin to learn more about how they can begin to teach the Constitution? If the American people don't understand the foundation of our freedom, how can we possibly hope to maintain it? And the exciting thing is that the Institute of the Constitution has classes being taught or about to be taught in some, what is it, 47 states?
47 states right now, which is very encouraging, as across America. I know I run into many Americans as I travel that say, I know something's wrong. You know, they have a visceral sense that something is wrong with America, and yet they can't quite put their finger on what it is. And as they take our course, Institute on the Constitution, they discover that the founding principles our founders established this country on have been long abandoned by those in power, with few exceptions, but the majority, vast majority of those in power. And the way to return to sound government and godly government is to return to those principles. So our course, Institute on the Constitution, is designed for anyone, really, anywhere with any group of people to communicate these truths. And we say that you're hosting the class, not really teaching the class, because we know that most people would be very, very leery about the idea of teaching the Constitution. They go, oh, I don't have the legal expertise or historic expertise. I really can't do that. But Dr. John Eismo, in 12 half-hour lectures on DVD, explains Christian history and heritage of our land. It explains in detail what each of the founding documents meant as it was originally written, not as it's been misinterpreted and abused since then. So a person comes away from this course with a working understanding of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights, and then subsequently what has happened to our land since the founding era. And we know that as people discover this, it will give them an ability to evaluate the promises being made by politicians running for office. And actually, we on our website, we give people a list of questions they ought to ask everyone running for office that they're making a determination if they're going to vote for. And that, by the way, our website is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. And on the front page, the very bottom of the page, the question is your elected representative competent? And one of those questions, a really basic one, is what's the purpose of government? You can discover an enormous amount about what a politician really believes with that simple question. What is the purpose of government?
If the purpose of government is to help people, then he doesn't understand the Constitution.
Right. And
the purpose of government is to give us freedom and to protect our God-given rights. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about. Well, before we go on, David, let's get your telephone number out.
So people can order our host kit online at iotconline.com, or they can call us toll-free, and that toll-free number is 1-866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796, and we're very encouraged as people are picking up this host kit all over the country, beginning to conduct classes and communicate the truths about what our founders believed about law and government that has been forgotten, neglected, and even denied today. The evildoers have gotten so bold that they're denying that the founders actually said the things they said, which, as you said earlier in the show, it's not difficult to understand what they meant by the words of the Constitution. They expounded on it clearly in the Federalist Papers James Madison's debates of what took place in the Constitution Convention. All the resources are available for us today to understand what it is they said, what it is they meant by each phrase and each clause of the Constitution.
And really what's so encouraging to me is that I know, for instance, this program is heard up in eastern Washington on four or five stations, and you've had quite a bit of response up there. I mean, they've had a number of these programs up there, haven't they?
That's right, and continuing to do so, at least two or three classes graduating each year, which is very encouraging, because what happens is one area of a state or part of the country becomes saturated, so many people will understand the Constitution that they will only permit someone to even run for office who is a constitutionalist. That is, whatever party they may belong to would be irrelevant. If they do not follow the terms of the Constitution, they would not be able to get elected, because there would be enough people in their district who demand that they follow the Constitution or they step down. They will not be permitted to achieve power. So as our program spreads across the country and begins to work its way into certain areas of the country, the change, we're going to see, it's going to take time, and people need to not lose hope, because it takes time to educate enough people to build a base of citizens such that the turnaround can take place. And we see some encouraging things. Some solid constitutionists did very well in this last election, and some interesting things took place out in some of the western states where the battles were most intense. But our founders said, this is a fixed standard. It doesn't change. And stepping into Article 1 there, first phrases of Article 1 is, all legislative power herein granted is vested in Congress, not in the President, not in the judges in the judiciary. In other words, judges don't make law, the President doesn't make law. All legislative power is in Congress alone. And of course, Congress is divided into two houses, the Houses of Representatives, popularly elected by district, representing the people of their district. In contrast, we have the Senate, that was originally designed and to be chosen by the state legislature before the 17th Amendment was ratified in 1915, if it was actually legally ratified. I've read good arguments against that, and the facts are probably true to that case. But the design was that the states would have a check upon the federal power. See, many people understand the three branches of government were to have checks and balances against one another, but they forget that the four levels of government were also to have a check upon one another. The federal level, the state level, the county level, and the local level, each of these four levels was to have a check. Particularly, the states were to have an enormous check on the power of the federal government. You mentioned earlier Federalist 45 that clearly spells this out, that the limited powers of the federal government were in contrast to the wide-ranging powers granted to the state governments. And that design was what the Senate was originally supposed to function as, that the states would speak to their senator and have their senator do their bidding as a legislature.
And I think it's so interesting. I told the story before, but it probably bears repeating. I have a program recently. One of the callers called in and said, you know, we're a democracy. We elect our representatives, and we elect our president, and they are to do our bidding. And I said, no, you're absolutely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
We elect our congressmen, but we do not elect, we were not supposed to elect our senators, because the founding fathers of America did not want a democracy. That's why they wanted the senators to be elected by the state governments, not by the individuals. We do not elect our president. He is elected by the Electoral College, because they did not want direct elections. They did not want direct democracy. In fact, everybody did not have the right to vote. In fact, originally it was only the men who had the right to vote, and you had to own property. Of course, these were decisions that were to be made by the state, but the federal government was never to interfere with voting. That was to be a state issue, and if you had corruption in the state, maybe you'd get a corrupt election. But that would have to be taken care of by the people there. Whenever you give the federal government the ability to go into the state to tell how the elections will be held, how do you know that they're going to be honest? And, of course, you don't. That was what our founding fathers feared, was corruption in the federal level, limit the power of the federal government, leave it to the people at the state and the local level. And you say, what happens if they don't do it? Well, you got two options. You can stay and fight it, or you can pick up and leave. What do you do when you have corruption that permeates every aspect of the federal level of government? Where do you go then?
And that's the danger our founders designed against with this structure of the Senate. They were designing against a monopoly power on the part of the federal government. And since the 17th Amendment, 1915, the monopoly power of the federal government has grown enormously every year, greater and greater and greater and greater power, now to things like the Patriot Act being renewed. I mean, just intrusive powers into the lives of every American. And if Americans don't wake up, we will all be slaves of the federal government in short order. And so the hour is late.
But I think people have to understand there have always been people who wanted a dictatorship in America. And you can go back and read some of the things that we have written about in the past. And you can trace this back literally hundreds of years back into the 1600s. There were people who came to this country and their intent was to make this into a dictatorship. And the people have left their emblems all throughout our society. And today, their primary goal is to create a world government and a new world religion. That's the reason Christmas is under attack. Do you think it's just by accident that most of the major chain stores in America told their employees not to say Merry Christmas, that they changed the name of the Christmas tree in Washington, D.C. to a holiday tree, that there are no nativity scenes up? You watch television, and there's nothing there about the Christmas story. If there is, why it always just sort of deprecated it really undermined the very concepts of the Christian heritage of our country. These things don't happen by accident. There really are those who realize that if they can destroy the Christian foundation of this nation, or the Judeo-Christian, if you prefer, why they can destroy the freedom of our nation and establish a tyranny, and then America will lead the whole world to the New World Order, the New World Religion, which is exactly what's going on today.
Well, their design is very wise of a two-house Congress, because the result of the two-house Congress means that legislation has to be weighed by two separate bodies of people. The second body, the Senate, being directly accountable to the state legislatures, really means that pieces of legislation wind up being weighed by three bodies of legislatively elected groups. And the result is that it's difficult to make a new law. And that should be understood by Americans to be a good thing. A good friend of mine who ran and won office here in the state of Maryland, Delegate Don Dwyer, when he was running for office, he went down to the law library to find out a question from a legal expert there at the law library of Maryland. And his question was simply this: can you tell me how many laws the citizen of Maryland is responsible for? In other words, that they're supposed to be obeying. How many laws is it that the citizens of Maryland are obligated to obey? And I said, well, Mr. Dwyer, you don't understand. We can't answer that question. He said, well, wait a minute. You're the law library. You're the experts here on the law. You have all the laws of the state of Maryland in your library right here. But you can't tell me the number of those laws that the citizens of the state of Maryland are subject to? They said, well, Mr. Dwyer, you don't understand. That's not possible. Nobody knows. Excuse me? Nobody knows. There's so many laws that are binding on us. And, of course, you're getting a court of law and you say, well, I didn't know about that. Ignorance is no excuse, right? Well, this is a ridiculous system, a system designed to make everybody lawbreakers.
And every time you pass a law, you take away a little freedom, and you take enough, pass enough laws, there is no freedom left, and that's what it's all about. You know, initially, you know, at the national level, the fellows are only, congressmen are only there for a few, a couple of months out of the year. Then they went home and made a living. And many of our states, they would hold their legislature there only for a few months out of the year. Some states, even to this day, the legislature only meets every other year. And I think it was Mark Twain who said that no man's life or property are really safe when the legislature is in session. You must understand that it has always been known that every time you pass a law, you take away freedom, and enough laws, there is no freedom.
And so they designed our system here where it was difficult to pass legislation because House of Representatives, popularly elected, had to pass it. The Senate, representing their state legislatures, had to agree to it. Consider any spending bill, like the pork barrel spending that's done so freely today. Well, when you have pork barrel spending, really what's taking place is a shift of wealth. Say, I don't know, pick any state you want. Say the state of Virginia contributes more money to the federal government than it actually takes back in pork barrel spending. So it's ultimately losing money. But say the state of, I don't know, just pick another state, Georgia or whatever. Say they're gaining more money in pork barrel legislation than they're actually spending. Well, would as such legislation ever pass a Senate if the Senate was accountable to the state legislature of Virginia as well as the state legislature of Georgia? No, they would say, you're not going to do that to us. You're not going to steal money from Virginia and give it to Georgia. We will not permit you to do that, and if you, as a senator, vote for such bills, you're quickly going to be fired and replaced with someone who will do the will of the state legislature. So there was a very powerful check upon the growth of the federal government and the growth of its taxing power, all the things that have contributed to a monopoly power on the level of the federal government were checked by this design between the House and the Senate, which very wisely they put together. Of course, they learned some from the English design. The English Parliament had the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and that was a helpful idea, but there was a more refined development of that, and actually a more powerful development of that in our land than in England.
Now, let me just tell a little story here about the Bridge to Nowhere. And this was a bridge that was built in Alaska. Now, Senator Stevens, is in charge of the Senate committee that apportions out the pork. And if you want to get something, you know, for your state, why, you're going to have to give him whatever he wants. So he gets probably, he and Senator Byrd of West Virginia get the maximum amount of money per capita for their state. And one of the things that was appropriated in Alaska was $250 million, $235 or $240 million for a bridge to an island where 50 people live. And it was known as the Bridge to Nowhere because, of course, the only people who owned property there would just happen to be Senator Stevens' daughter had a large piece of land very close to where this Bridge to Nowhere was going to be. Why would you spend $250 million, $1 billion, to build a bridge to an island with 50 people on it? Well, you know, this was brought up as an absurdity of the pork process, of the wasteful spending of federal money. So the congressmen, in their righteous indignation, and the senators, withdrew the money for the Bridge to Nowhere and just gave the money to the government of Alaska to use whichever way they wanted, which will probably end up with a bridge being built to nowhere. So, but you see, if you're spending somebody else's money, it really doesn't matter as long as you're going to get some of it for yourself, for your district. And what we've done is totally corrupted the whole legislative process in Washington, D.C., Money comes in easy, it goes out easy, and if you get enough money in your legislative district, you're going to get reelected. David, let's get your telephone number out.
Yes.
One more time.
Our toll-free number is 1-866-740-9149. 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796.
And let's get your webpage out again so people know how to get in touch with you.
Is iotconline.com.
iotconline.com. Get in touch with him. Find out what you, how you can set up one of these institutes in your community. Help us preserve our freedom. Well, David, why don't you pick up the story there?
So the two houses of Congress would cool hothead legislation. There was a conversation. We're not sure if it was apocryphal or it actually took place, where Washington was asked, why two houses? And he said, well, wouldn't you have your cup of tea? And, of course, tea is many of these English descendants drank regularly. He said, to cool your tea, what do? You pour it between the saucer and back into the cup. So you cool it and soothe it by pouring it between these two. And that's the reason why two houses can soothe and cool hothead legislation that otherwise might have gone through if there was not proper time for reflection. And, of course, senators are chosen differently, and usually they serve staggered terms of 6 years. And so that's a different pattern than the House of Representatives. So all of that required a lot more cooperation for any piece of legislation that would actually make it all the way through that kind of process. And the other issue we need to remember here is we are a republic, we're not a democracy, and a bicameral legislature may actually thwart the will of the majority of people in the land. The majority of people want X, and the legislative process says, well, no, that's not a good thing. So the framers thought legislature sometimes should thwart the will of the majority, because they rightly distrusted popular majorities. They had a favorite term for democracy, which every time, it would help you to understand this, every time you heard one of our politicians or presidents or judges talk about we're a democracy, put our founders' term in its place. They called a democracy a mobocracy. That is a unruly, out of control, lawless bunch of people doing whatever they choose. And so we need to understand the differences are stark between a republican form of government, which is indirect through representatives, and a democracy, which is people directly voting on legislation. In a republic, law is always supreme.
And of course, even if the majority of the legislators want to do it, if it's unconstitutional, then they become lawbreakers.
That's right. The law is supreme. All men, including the elected officials, appointed officials, all of them are subject to the law. And in our constitutional republic, that supreme law is the law of God. And then the supreme law of the land is the Constitution. So in a republic, the minority always have rights which even a majority of people may not violate.
And of course, when they take our money to give it to some other state, you know, to buy the re-election of a politician there, that's not only immoral, it's unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. David Whitney, we're out of time. Thank you so very much.
Oh, God bless you, Dr. Stan, for all you're doing.
And we'll look forward to having you with us again next month.
All right, thank you.
Good night, God bless. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we need to remind our listeners of Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters and helping us as we, 5 hours a day, reach out across America, indeed across the world, by the miracle of Internet and shortwave, and now we have our own satellite up there, that Telstar 5, and you can listen to our program up there 9 hours a day. In fact, you can listen to a little group we put together, a network, 24 hours a day, and we'll be telling you how to get this inexpensive receiver, and you don't have to listen to the vile material that's on regular radio. You can actually get the truth out there, and we do, many of you will give serious consideration to helping us as we try to expand our outreach to educate the American people about the true nature of freedom. Now, as I mentioned earlier, there have always been people here that really wanted the dictatorship going back hundreds of years. How could this go on from century to century, from generation to generation? Well, very simply, there is an occult hierarchy. There are spiritual forces at work. And you can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And pull down our newsletters on the occult hierarchy. And that would be the May and June newsletters of this year, 2005, at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Or we have pamphlets we put together, made up of my newsletters, called The Occult Hierarchy, Part 1, Part 2, Part 3. And you can go to our website and learn more about that, www.radioliberty.com. If you go to our website, if you have access to the Internet, you can listen to our radio programs, our Internet programs, directly or indirectly, 5 hours a day. We're on the American Freedom Network, the Genesis Network, and the Radio Liberty Network. And then, of course, you can listen to our archive programs, and we encourage you to ask others and encourage others to do exactly the same thing. And then, of course, we hope that you'll pull down our newsletters and copy them and get them to other people. We must educate the American people. If you want to understand the war in Iraq, because you certainly would want to get our latest newsletter, it's called Deja Vu in Iraq. And, of course, it's simply pointing out that Iraq is being used basically as a distraction, and while our attention is focused on Iraq, we're losing our freedom here at home. Same thing exactly happened during the Vietnam War. And while our boys were fighting supposedly for freedom in Vietnam, the Supreme Court took God and prayer out of our schools and began to expand the laws that were anti-Christian laws in this country, found women had a right to abortion, changed our immigration law, began centralizing all power in Washington, D.C., and violated every tenet of our Constitution. But you see, we weren't watching what our Supreme Court was doing, what our legislature was doing. We weren't watching the war on poverty, the war on drugs. War on drugs, we have more drugs. War on poverty, we have more poverty. And, of course, now we have a war on terrorism, and we have far more terrorism. Understand what this is all about? Remember our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, our website, RadioLiberty.com, and then pray for America. Pray for revival, pray for our leaders, and pray for our ministers, but please remember to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and, well, we had hoped to have Cheryl Hancock with us this evening, and Cheryl has been over in Israel and is a missionary there, and some fascinating stories to tell us about what's really going on in Israel, but right now doesn't seem to be able to get hold of her, so we're going to invite your calls from out across America, and we'll probably be doing open lines here, so give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295. Well, let's talk a little bit about the background to what is going on in Iraq today. Now, first of all, the people debate back and forth, should we stay in Iraq and continue doing what we're doing? Should we pull out of Iraq? And the fear is that if we pull out of Iraq, there'll be a full-scale civil war that will go on there. And I'm sure that's absolutely right. There's a tremendous amount of animosity between the Shia Muslims and the Sunni Muslims, and certainly the Sunnis have certainly overloaded the Shias for a long period of time, and right now the Shias are in the process of capturing and killing and torturing we're getting things on the screen here, and I can't read them and talk at the same time. And right now, of course, we're getting real problems as far as the conflicts are there, and there's an awful lot of just killing, blatant killing of Iraqi civilians. If we pull out, things will be far worse. If we stay, things will not get any better. You cannot force democracy on this country. What we have done is we took a secular state, where 10% of the population were Christians. The Christians have all fled the country because they realize that they're going to be living under Sharia law, and Christians cannot live under Sharia law, and we've allowed that to be put into the Constitution. We've actually then allowed the Shia Muslims of the southern Iraq to form a bond with Iran, and we've expanded the Shia Muslim Iranian control into a large segment of Iraq. We took a stable country, admittedly was headed by a tyrant, but then aren't the people in Saudi Arabia tyrants? Aren't the kingdom in Kuwait tyrants? Isn't the man we installed in Rhodesia today a tyrant? So why were we so concerned about Saddam Hussein? After all, he'd been our ally. We had backed him. He had originally started out as a CIA asset, as a paid assassin for the CIA, and we helped him to come to power in 1979, and we financed him all during the 1980s. Now, we gave him massive loans, and if you doubt that, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Ask for the Washington Post article about when an ally becomes an enemy. When an ally becomes an enemy, we'll be glad to send that to you. And then, of course, we hope that many of you out there will want to get some of the material we have going into the background of how the United States government had financed this whole Islamic terrorist movement. And we've actually put together a number of little pamphlets called Foreknowledge 911 Part 1, Part 2, Part 3, and they really do go into great detail of the background of how it was our Central Intelligence Agency that had brought the Ayatollah government to power in Iran, that had financed the Islamic movement in Afghanistan, and how we had actually passed out Korans in Afghanistan and let the people there believe this was part of this whole resurgence of the Islamic faith, how we provided textbooks for promoting radical Islam. Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and right now we're going to just have open lines. So if you're out there across America, give us a call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Under any circumstances, you really can't understand where this whole movement came from and why we were really in Iraq today, unless you understand ancient history. My good friend, Dr. Dennis Cuddy, has sent me a map. It was drawn up in 1950 by one of the people who was part of this whole movement towards world government. And in this map, written in 1950, it told where the troops would be from the various nations, where they would be stationed at the end time as we began moving towards world government. And where do you think the American troops were to be stationed according to this 1950 map? Why, we were to be stationed in the Middle East, right where we are today. So this was planned at least back in 1950. If you read the book written by H.G. Wells, it was about 1933 he wrote a book. And in that book, if any of you want to get the exact title, you can call us and we'll get it for you. But it actually talked about, and it was written from a fictional point of view, but he actually talked about the beginning of the Second World War. He said it would start in 1939 with an incident between Poland and Germany. So H.G. Wells knew exactly what lay ahead. I think the book was called The Shape of Things to Come. And then we know that then he went on to talk about how there would be a third try at world order, because they realized that the Second World War would not bring about this new world order that H.G. Wells believed in. And so basically he wrote about how the third try at the New World Order would come out of a conference that would be held in Basra about 1988. Now, of course, his timing was way off, and it wasn't a conference. It was certainly the war in the Middle East that is the third try at the New World Order. My good friend William Sneblin, and Bill Sneblin was a Satanist. He was deeply involved in the occult. He was told by his mentor, who was a Satanist, his name was Manly P. Hall, and this was in the early 1980s, that there would be a Third World War. Hall told him about the war in 1991, the Desert Storm, and then told him about the coming Third World War that would start in the year 2000 with Saddam Hussein. Of course, the war didn't start until 2003. But this was all planned long ahead of time, because there really are spiritual forces there that are directing the course of human events. Well, apparently we've got Cheryl Hancock on the line now. Hi, Cheryl. Thanks. Good to have you with us.
It's good to be with you.
Well, let's go a little bit in the background for our listeners who don't know who you are. Why don't you give our listeners just a little of your background?
Okay, well, I am from the Central Coast, Pismo Beach area in California, and I worked at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant for 10 years as an armed security officer. I was a drug addict before that for 19 years. I became a Christian in 1989 and just gave my life to the Lord. And after 10 years of working at the power plant, I was called over to Israel, and I moved to Israel about 7 years ago and began working with Christian ministries, and now I'm working out in the fields in the jungles of Israel.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about it? Because you're really over there as a missionary, but of course, you have to be a little careful in what you do. But actually, what's going on in Israel today? Is there a lot of violence there, or are things really fairly safe for most people?
Well, I would say that if you know where you're going, it's fairly safe. They try to keep the tourists as safe as possible, because both the Palestinian people and the Israeli people want the tourists there. So there are no attacks on tourists. But the areas that you can go into that are very dangerous, most people stay away from. But these are some of the areas that I go into, because there's a lot of people out there that have not heard the gospel. And you're right, I am a missionary. I do humanitarian aid. I also do reports. I'm a journalist over there. And so I have a few different things that I do. But it's very important to get to where the people are. As far as the safety in Israel, there are attacks happening all the time, and there are, as I heard on the news recently, 9 out of 10 attacks are stopped in Israel every day.
And so they really have pretty good security over there. I mean, certainly I think certainly their police, their intelligence is excellent. Like probably the best in the world.
Yeah, the security is very good. That's why they are stopping 9 out of 10 of the attacks, and they have take a lot of precautions.
Well, now, what about the idea of they're going to war with Iran? We hear a lot of talk here in the United States that suggests that Israel is very, very concerned about Iran getting nuclear weapons and is threatening, you know, to attack Iran. You know, and both Netanyahu and Sharon are talking about the possibility. Is there any truth to that?
Well, yeah, there is a nuclear plant in Iran now, and Iran is talking about building a second one. Actually, they asked America to bid on the job, but Ariel Sharon and Netanyahu, Bibi Netanyahu, both said that they will not tolerate a nuclear Iran. They believe that Iran can be ready in 3 months to attack Israel.
We're talking about 3 months from now, you mean?
3 months from now, yes.
So basically what we're hearing for our listeners out there is they're talking about the possibility of a preemptive strike, an Israeli preemptive strike on Iran sometime between now and, what, March or April?
Yeah, this is the rumor going around right now in Israel that, as a matter of fact, how it's worded is Iran could have a bomb within a few months. So Netanyahu says that Israel should bomb Iran first.
And, of course, how could we object to that? We've established preemptive war is perfectly all right. If you think you might be attacked, you want to attack your enemy first. So the United States certainly could not object to that. But what do you think the implication would be as far as the Middle East is concerned? And, if you know, certainly nobody else is going to back Israel except the United States. And if we back their preemptive strike on Iran, could this draw us into World War III, do you think?
Well, what's going on in the news, I don't know if you've heard that the president of Iran said that Israel should be wiped off the map. And then as he was approached by the UN and the EU about this statement, he said, okay, well, maybe Israel should just be moved to Europe, which is ridiculous, of course. So Israel is really threatened by this attack that it probably will have from Iran. So if Israel does go and bomb and doesn't have the backing of the United States or the UN or the EU, yeah, it could cause a lot of problems, as we know, and it could start a big war.
But of course the thing is the United States is pouring a tremendous amount of money into Israel, but then of course we're pouring a tremendous amount of money into Egypt, and we're giving a lot of money to the PLO. And we're even appropriating money to give to Saudi Arabia and Pakistan. Aren't we just nice? We're just giving money to everybody, especially those people who are financing the terrorists. Because a boss there in the PLO, head of the PLO, is actually setting up a fund providing money for the families of the insurgents that are killing the Americans. But, well, of course, we wouldn't want to cut off funds to them because then we couldn't continue influencing them. At least that seems to be the rationale. How we tend to justify financing the people who are killing Americans and, of course, killing Israelis as well. Well, we're now, as far as your experience with the Palestinians, and of course, are you working primarily with the Palestinians or primarily with the Israelis?
Well, actually, I work across the board with all of them, but lately there has been a group of Palestinians, we call them collaborators, or they call them collaborators. These are people who have given up information to the Israeli authorities about attacks that were going to be happening to civilians on buses, suicide bombings, and things like this. Well, these Palestinians give up this information to Israel, then they're called traitors by the Palestinian Authority and by Hamas and by their own people, and they're called collaborators. So they have to seek refuge in Israel proper, and I just seem to have run into a big group of these people that have no hope at all, and they're reaching up for hope, and a lot of them are becoming believers. But I'm getting stories from their hearts of what's going on, why they're doing this, and how the Palestinian people are being so oppressed that some of them don't have any choice but to send their children or to go in and become suicide bombers so their family has money and food.
Well, now, what about the people that are collaborators? Why are they collaborating with Israel?
Well, there's different reasons. Some are criminal, and they're trying to get away from the system in PA. They don't want to go to jail, so they run into Israel proper. They know they get refuge there. But most of them are doing it because they don't want to see a busload of women and children being blown up. They don't agree, and they're being pulled in. If they want food, if they want money, if they want to be supported by the PA or by Hamas, then they have to do favors for them. You know, I have a short letter here. I don't know if you mind if I read it.
Not at all. That's what this is for.
Okay, this is from, I just got this email from these guys that I'm working with, these guys I'm talking about. Some of them have become believers, but they say this: we are an oppressed people, and most of the world is unaware of our problems. We are without freedom and arrested and taken to prison for our faith. And I know a lot of them that have been tortured and put in prison, and one in particular for 2 years.
No, this was a Palestinian?
A Palestinian man who was a Muslim, and he became a believer. And when he did, and he told his whole village about Jesus, then they took him in for questioning, interrogation. They began torturing him, and then they put him in prison in Nablus for 2 years. So they go on to say, many children and families here are in hunger and do not have proper clothing for the winters. The Palestinian Authority only helps those people that belong to them. They keep the people dependent upon their aid, but in return they require much. Most people suffer from lack of medical care. The cost of medical without insurance prevents them from seeking help. However, the PA has the best of care and go to the best doctors. So if you work for the PA or you work for Hamas, you go to the best places. But the poor go without or they're controlled by the PA. So the aid that is sent to the PA only supports those that are in control and does not help the common people.
So what we are really doing is helping the ruthless people who are in control.
That's right.
That are fomenting the terrorism. And it's supposedly we're giving this money to help the Palestinian people, but it's really not going to the Palestinian people, is it?
No, the money is going to have more control for the Palestinian Authority over the people.
Now, why would the United States be financing the Palestinian Authority that's financing terrorism? That doesn't make sense.
No, that's a very good question. And I spoke in the Capitol building last year, in 2004. I spoke in the Capitol building, and I showed some Palestinian Authority television. I spoke to senators, congressmen, some White House staff, and showed them the problems that are going on, told them some of these things. And one of the senators came up to me and says, I know this is going on. But what is being done? Nothing, really.
Well, now, Chris, do they have their own television stations, or do they actually broadcast over this Al Jazeera?
Yeah, they also have local television stations. And the problem is, there's a lot of Palestinians that are Christian, that are Syrian Orthodox Christians, different types of Christians. But because they all speak Arabic, they listen to this television, which is mainly propaganda. And so even the Christians that I work with over there, the Catholic and the Syrian Orthodox, they call me and they say, do you hear what those Jews are doing today? And I said, no, what are they doing? And then they tell me their version, what they heard on television. And I say, no, it didn't happen that way. This is the way it happened. They said, no, I saw it on television. They believe what they see.
No, no, of course. Are they watching Al Jazeera, or are they listening to local Palestinian television?
Both. Al Jazeera is one of the biggest ones. Of course, they all watch that, but they also listen to the local. Let's say it's Bethlehem, they listen to that.
All right. And I think that for our listeners out there, there is much evidence that the Al Jazeera is a British intelligence asset, and this was created. Now, whether that's true or not, I don't know, but I will tell you that Al Jazeera is here in the United States. We get on Telstar 5, an American satellite. You can watch it. Why would we be allowing a Al Jazeera, which is the terrorist television network, to be broadcasting on an American satellite right here in the United States? Just so many of these things just don't make sense, do they?
No, they don't. It just doesn't make sense what's going on in this world. And even people back over there in the Middle East don't understand. We see what's going on. The people see what's going on. These people that wrote this letter to you tonight, they're saying, why don't people care? Why don't people know these things? Yet the government does know these things. As a matter of fact, our government is wanting to make a Palestinian state. With the authority that's there, the authority that's there is not a democratic society, not at all. And so why would we make these people live under the regime that is there right now that's oppressing these people? The leadership needs to be changed in the Palestinian Authority.
No question at all, and yet, of course, we are not going to do that. We're going to continue, I fear, backing Arafat, or Sir Arafat is now long gone with all of his billions of dollars we gave him, and now some other corrupt terrorist leader is in charge, and we're financing him. We're going to be back here in just a moment with Cheryl Hancock and talking more about her experiences over there in Israel and the surrounding areas. Well, Cheryl, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's happening as far as your experience and your association with the Palestinians. These people, perhaps have been collaborators. They've had to come to Israel because they'd be killed if they stayed in the Palestinian area. Many of these people really want to turn to Christianity. Are they curious about Christianity? Many of them are actually having frank conversions.
Yeah, well, what's going on is one of the guys that I work with, he was in a Nablus jail for 2 years because he became a believer and we stood for his faith. And all the collaborators that were in the same prison with him that were supposed to be executed, when the IDF went in and busted down the walls, they all ran and they were free. And so Israel has given them permission to stay in Israel proper, but their families have to stay in the villages in the West Bank. So, first of all, they're separated from their families. Now, we're talking about hundreds of men that have been collaborators. A lot of them knew this man I'll call Smiley, and they come to his house. They hear about him. They hear about Christians helping him, and they want to know what's going on because, see, the Jewish people do not trust these collaborators because they're Palestinians, and they don't know if they're going to be a bomber or what. And then the Israeli Arabs don't trust them either because they call these guys traitors to their people, the Islamic people. So no one loves these people. So here we are, just a handful of people that go in and love these guys. We take them food and clothing and medicine and try to help them in different ways. And they ask why, and we tell them why, about the Lord. And they are finding the Lord left and right. As a matter of fact, there's not enough time to go to each one that wants to hear about the Lord. So I'm taking them, and we're getting them baptized. And what's so funny, I get excited when I talk about them. But these guys, when they want to leave their religion, let's say Islam, they want to be baptized first because that's their showing that they're leaving their religion. I'm leaving Islam and I want to be a Christian, so baptize me and then teach me. And so what we do is we take them down when they want to be baptized, we baptize them, and then we talk to them and they start growing in the Lord, and there is such a change in their heart. Actually, they start loving the Jewish people. And that's when you know that there's been a change in their heart.
And of course, that's really the only solution for the problem over there between the Arabs and the Israelis is Christianity. And if, you know, if the Israeli is a Christian, he's not going to hate the Palestinians. And if a Palestinian is a Christian, they're not going to hate the Israelis. That's the only solution. As I always said, you know, we had these fellows down in Guantanamo, and of course we were mistreating them and keeping them in shackles and giving them copies of the Quran. And what we should have done then was treated nicely and give them a Bible, but we didn't do that. And really, of course, it's only Christianity that's going to change the hearts of men. So, now, what are these people doing for a living, though? Do they have any means of livelihood?
Yeah, it's a problem because most of them are not allowed to work in Israel. They're allowed to stay in Israel, and it's a temporary thing right now. So they can't work. They don't have driver's license. Usually the PA, when they take them in for interrogation, they take away any passport or visa or any identification that they have, so they can't travel. They don't have freedom. So they're in Israel proper trying to find jobs, and a lot of them work in construction. They get ripped off, you know, because they're out there working, and the people that hire them know that these guys have no rights. So they are really... they're really having trouble. Now, the guy Smiley that I'm working with, he's making olive oil soap. His family makes it in the West Bank, and they send it to him, and we help him package it and get it out to the public so that he can support his family. Another guy's family is making baskets in Samaria, and he's getting these baskets out slowly. So we're helping them, trying to raise money, trying to get them to raise money for themselves to support their families.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Cheryl. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're talking with Cheryl Hancock, who is living over in Israel. She's home for a short sabbatical, but she'll be going back again, God willing, in a couple of months she'll be going back?
Yes, I'll be doing a speaking tour here on the West Coast first.
All right, fine. And so then what about the Israelis you talk to? Are many of the people there interested in Christianity? Certainly, so many Israelis really don't even adhere to the Jewish faith, do they?
That's true. There's a lot of what we call secular Israelis, but a lot of them keep the Sabbath, the Shabbat. They keep the feast. They're like Sunday Christians or, holiday Christians, I guess. You go to church when it's Easter and Christmas. But then there are a lot that really do try to keep the faith. And then you have your Messianic Jews. And these Messianic Jews are the ones that believe that the Messiah has come, and the Messiah, of course, is Jesus Christ. And they're coming out of the closet, these Messianic Jews. They're starting to go and tell the other Jewish people about the Messiah, that he has come, and his name is Yeshua. And there's a lot of trouble that goes along with that. I'm working with a group of people down in Arad, which is a desert, Negev desert, and they came under attack by ultra-Orthodox Jews because they have a chess club. In this chess club, they have Bibles. When the guys come in to play chess, if they want to hear about the Lord, they tell them. And so it was burnt down by the ultra-Orthodox. They firebombed it one night, and the whole thing was gutted out. So I went and helped them clean out this place, and now it's back in working order, but they're still having attacks. I was attacked when I was over there. Mainly it's verbally. They take pictures of you. They put your picture on a poster, and they hang it over the neighborhood and say, this is a missionary, beware.
Well, if there's nothing to Christianity, why would they be worried if there was missionaries there? Or are they fearful that what you're saying is true and people are going to come to know the Lord?
Yeah, I questioned one of them. I talked to him for quite a while, and I asked him what the problem was and why he was attacking these Christians. And he told me that it's been the same for thousands of years, hundreds of years, that Christians have been coming. He started with the Crusaders. They come, and they want to take the soul of the Jewish person. And if you take the soul of the Jewish person and you make them a Christian, they are no longer a Jewish person, and you're wiping out the Jews. So they're afraid that the Christians are wiping out the Jews by converting them.
Well, of course, some people think that they're completing Jews. In fact, many Jews who become Christians believe that they're completed Jews, and this is the only way that they, you know, can ever really be true to their faith.
And that's the truth. They are completed Jews. The only difference is these guys' eyes are blinded. They can't see the truth. So it's a very sad situation. I felt very sad when I talked to this one guy. He just couldn't see the truth. And they're missing out. They're missing out on knowing their Messiah, knowing their God personally.
Well, now, of course, certainly, what about the economy over there in Israel? Is it able to function fairly effectively? Are there jobs for most of the people?
Yeah, there are actually so many immigrants that have been coming to Israel, and more are coming, a lot from North America. Jobs are very scarce. The wage is not as high as in America, and the cost of living is very high. As a matter of fact, a gallon of gas is over $6.
But you mean actually a lot of American Jews are going to Israel?
Yes, it's a new phenomena.
Why would that be at this time in history?
Well, that's what they're wondering. But just in 2004, there were 2,800 North Americans that came, and that was the largest number in 20 years. So since 2004, North American Jews have been immigrating back to Israel. It's picking up. And even though the cost of living is lower and jobs are harder to get, and the cost of living is higher, and jobs are very difficult to get.
And, of course, what do you do? I mean, it's certainly you're not going to have the big jobs in construction you would have here. With the jobs in technology, I know they do a lot of diamond grinding, things like that, but you have to have years and years of experience for that. Even to become a guide over there in Israel, for the tourists, it takes you 2 or 3 years of training before you can get a license to do that.
Yes, that's right, and a lot of guides are out of work because the tourist industry has really fallen a lot. It's starting to pick up now. When I left Israel, we had so many tourist buses, it was almost like the old days, that you could hardly get around Jerusalem. So it's picking up. But yes, actually computer technology is very big in Israel, cell phones. But, it's very difficult to get a good job over there in Israel.
And yet, of course, American Jews are going over. Are these fairly prosperous Jews going? Or are these?
Yeah. Some are doctors, some are lawyers. There's all kinds of different ones, yeah.
Well, of course, we're told that, that the Jews were going to return to the Holy Land. Is this this is strange, or maybe this foretells some very exciting events that are going to occur, because I believe, of course, that the center of prophecy is the Holy Land. Would you agree with that?
Oh, of course, I agree with that. There's so much going on now prophetically, it's unbelievable.
And I think until the American people begin to understand that behind all of the news events that we hear, behind all the current events, are the spiritual forces at work, and we can't begin to grasp the significance of what's taking place. We'll be back in just a moment with Cheryl. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Cheryl Hancock, and we talked to Cheryl when she was here in the United States before, and we've been getting her emails on a regular basis since she's been over there, keeping us abreast of her adventures. Of course, we'd love to be doing exactly what she's doing, but, well, maybe we each have our calling, but I think what she's doing is potentially dangerous. Well, it's not just potentially dangerous, it's very dangerous, and yet it's such an important thing to be able to reach these Palestinians for the Lord. And what about for the Israelis? Are you having any results yourself bringing the Israelis to know the Lord?
Yes, the Israelis are very open, especially during this time when there's the hope's really gone down, especially after Gaza, when the Jewish people had to leave the Gaza Strip. The country was torn. A lot of us just sat and watched and cried. I mean, it was just awful. And so as the hope level lowers, they start reaching up, and they're open to hear about the Lord. They want to know about my relationship with the Lord. They want to know what I believe. And so I find people there in Israel much more open than here in America.
Well, what about the people from Gaza? What, there were 7,000 or 8,000 of them were forced to give up their homes. Some of them had been living there for 50 years. Their families had been there. And then, of course, they had their beautiful greenhouses. They were growing flowers and all sorts of fruits and vegetables, and really a tremendous source of food and income for the nation of Israel. Why did Sharon decide to betray his promise and force the people to leave Gaza?
Well, no one really knows, but one of the guesses is that a lot of people say that it was Americans' push on Sharon, that Sharon gave in as a puppet to America. And so people are upset with America over this whole ordeal, over President Bush, because of it, because of the funding. And now the people that had to leave Gaza knew that in the past Israel gave up much land, and there was no change with the Palestinians. They still fought. In Gaza Strip today, they built a launching pad, I guess it was last week or the week before, but Israel bombed it just last week, and they were shooting missiles into Israel. That hasn't changed. And they also found weapons coming through the seaport. They opened up a port down in Gaza, and now weapons come from Egypt, and of course now through the Egyptian border. Nothing has changed on the Palestinian side. Yet all these people were displaced, and the country was torn over it.
And, of course, the thing is that Israel got absolutely nothing in return for actually betraying the residents of Gaza, the Jewish residents, the 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people there. And the question then arises, why would they have done something this foolish? They sort of could have got some sort of a promise, some agreement not to have terrorism there, and they didn't even ask for it. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest is Cheryl Hammond, and of course, right now I'd like Cheryl to get out her web space and perhaps her email and her telephone number, because Cheryl certainly is a missionary. She does this on her own, and people support her, and if you're interested in knowing more about her ministry or perhaps even supporting her, why don't you at least, Cheryl, go ahead and get out your address and telephone number.
Yeah, you know what I'll do? I don't have a website, and I do that purposely, because the things I talk about, even tonight on the radio, I just have to really be careful, because there's families that are attached to the guys that I'm working with that are in the West Bank, and they do get attacked by the Palestinian Authority and by Hamas. And so I don't have a website because of that, but I do have an email address. And I can give that. And
go ahead.
The name is Grateful, GRATEFUL, at ACTCOM, ACTCOM .co.il.
Give that one more.
Okay, it's Grateful, spelled GRATEFUL, at ACTCOM, ACTCOM .co.il.
All right, fine. That's grateful at com, ATCOM, ACTCOM, at com, dot CO dot IL. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine. And so if you're interested, and I certainly, Cheryl will send you her emails. We get them on a regular basis just to find out what's going on over there. And we think that this is such an important ministry, and it's important to us here at Radio Liberty to know what's really going on, because she gives you an entirely different approach and vision of what's taking place in the Holy Land today than you're going to get from reading so many of the things that are available to us here. Well, if you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question, a comment for Cheryl Hancock, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Now, as far as the, how many Palestinian men would you say that we're dealing with? Several hundred Palestinian men have had to flee into Israel to live under these very difficult circumstances just because they're not safe going back into the Palestinian-controlled area?
Yeah, there's a lot of them that are in Israel proper right now. But the problem is, you know, the wall, the fence is going up. The Israelis are building this wall, the fence, and what they want is to get the Palestinian people back to the Palestinian areas and have the Jewish people who live inside the Israeli areas. Wait, did I say that right? Palestinian people back in the West Bank and the Jewish people back into Israel proper. So they're separating some of those Palestinians. Now, they each have a hearing to go to that's coming up, and I know Smiley's is coming up December 19th. And it will determine whether he's sent back to the PA, to the West Bank, or if he gets to stay in Israel proper.
But wouldn't his life be in real serious jeopardy if he was sent back to the Palestinian area?
It would be a death sentence for him, yes.
All right, so how long is this wall going to be? I mean, we hear all sorts of conflicting things about the wall, but will this wall go to the whole area between the Palestinian area and the Israeli area?
Yeah, it would have to. They said it's only one-third of the way done. They have two-thirds of it to go. They are putting the pieces, the blocks, together, but they haven't put them in place because there's so much controversy over it right now. But it has helped in stopping a lot of attacks in Israel.
Well, now, what about the Arabs there? In fact, you know, there are a fair number of Arabs who would live in certainly in the Israeli area, and some of them are Muslim and some of them are Christian Arabs. What about them?
Yeah, well, the sad thing is that a lot of them would be separated from their friends and family members that are in the West Bank. I have friends that are in Bethlehem, and when I go in to see my friends, I go into past this huge, huge wall, like going into a prison, and it's very intimidating. And I get a sense of how they feel, just a little bit. So it's a very sad situation, but what can Israel do? How can they stop these attacks? This is one of the solutions they came up with.
Well, now, of course, are these friends of yours, are these Palestinian Christians, are these Palestinian Muslims, or what?
Yeah, the ones in Bethlehem, I know a lot of the Palestinian Christians. They're Orthodox, Syrian Orthodox, and Greek Orthodox, and Catholic.
I thought that they'd forced most of the Christians out of Bethlehem.
Yes, you're right. It used to be a Christian town, and now it's mainly Muslim, because they keep running them out. The Muslims will attack the Christians, the Orthodox Christians there. And I'm talking about the few that have stayed. Those are the ones I go in and visit.
Because I know a lot of them, you had stores there, and when we used to go in, you know, on our tour bus, we'd always stop at the stores owned by the Palestinian Christians. And but I guess my understanding is most of them have just been really sort of given an opportunity to either get out or we'll kill you.
Yeah, and a lot of them, they can't even open their stores anymore because there aren't hardly any tourists going into Bethlehem. It's a very dangerous place to go, and the Israeli guides do not want to go in there.
Well, what about the trips to Israel? Certainly, are there plenty of things to see there in the Israeli area to keep the tourists busy?
Oh, my goodness. There is so much to see. It's incredible. As a matter of fact, when I'm there and I have friends come over, I have them come and do some archaeology with me. And to me, it's very exciting because they have taken some of the stuff from the Temple Mount, when the Muslims were building a new mosque on the Temple Mount, underneath the Temple Mount, they threw all these artifacts over into the Kidron Valley. Well, the people, the Jewish people, they salvaged this stuff, and we're sifting through the dirt, and we're finding all kinds of things. And so it's fun for the tourists to come and be a part of some of the digs there. And, of course, the sites are the same, the Sea of Galilee. There's so many things to see, but I would encourage people to go to Bethlehem also.
Well, now, of course, we've heard a lot of things about how the Arabs were working there on Temple Mount, and they were digging under the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and even under the Mosque of Omar, to try to get any of the artifacts out of there that might suggest at one time the Israelis had been there, and as a result, they were beginning to undermine the foundation of those great structures. Is there any truth to that?
Yes, it was bulging. The wall was bulging out, and they thought it was going to collapse, so they brought in some Jordanians to fix it. They wouldn't trust the Israelis. But let me tell you about that archaeology. When they threw that stuff out, because they threw it out, see, Israel has no right to the Temple Mount right now. They've given their right up. And so because they threw those things out, now Israel has a chance to go through that dirt. And what they're trying to do is prove that the Bible is true, prove that the Jews had a right to the Temple Mount, that they did live in Jerusalem. As I was sifting one day, I found a Babylonian arrowhead. What this proves is that the Babylonians came and took the Jews into captive into Babylon. It was one of the biggest finds from the Temple Mount. And so now I have an in with all the archaeologists because I found that arrowhead. They also found a seal from the first temple. So the Jewish people are proving that the Jews do have a right to Jerusalem. Now this is going to have a big effect on what happens.
No, but you're never going to convince the Muslims, because they've had their fixed opinion, and they want to claim the Temple Mount to themselves, and I have never understood why Moshe Dayan, after the 1967 war, turned the control of the Temple Mount back to the Arabs. I mean, when they won the war, they should have kept it and just said that we won, and that's a problem. What we've done is left a festering sore there right in the very heart of Jerusalem.
Yeah, nobody can understand why he did that, and the answer always comes out is maybe it wasn't the time. Maybe it wasn't timing yet. So nobody can understand that.
Well, there's so much history, and I really think that the history of the latter days, and I honestly believe we are entering the latter days, I think it will all continue to center around Israel and the Holy Land.
Mm-hmm.
You have that feeling?
Oh, yes, I definitely have that feeling. And being in the midst over there, you can see it happening in front of your eyes.
And, of course, I feel very, very sorry for the Arabs. If they're there, they're living as second-class citizens. But, of course, you have this constant conflict between the Muslims and the Jews, and it's been going on since the beginning of time. The group I feel sorriest for are the Palestinian Christians, because they aren't really accepted by either side, are they?
Pardon? They're not what?
They're really not accepted by the Muslims, and they're not accepted by the Israelis.
Right, yeah. My friends tell me they have the hardest time because the Muslims attack them, and then the Israelis, the Jewish people, don't like them because they're Palestinians or they're Arabs.
Right.
Yeah. People stuck in between, just like those collaborators that I'm working with. I just seem to always work with the underdogs, and those are the groups that
They're the ones, of course, that need you most. I mean, the thing, of course, everybody really needs the message of salvation, but the easiest ones to reach usually are the ones that are the most needy. And certainly I saw this in my own life when I was practicing medicine, and most doctors really don't need God. I mean, they're almost like gods unto themselves making life and death decisions. But when some personal tragedy would strike a doctor's family, lose a loved one or a wife, or there'd be a problem with their practice or something, and suddenly they begin to doubt, this almost omnipotence that they have. And at that point, they begin looking for a solution. And it was at that point that many of them came to know the Lord.
Mm-hmm. And what I'm finding is that the people over there, they need love. It doesn't matter if they're Palestinian collaborators or Orthodox Christians or Jewish people. Even though the Jewish people are tough on the outside, they're very soft and they want to be loved on the inside. And once they see that you're loving them, the doors are completely wide open for you to talk to them. And it's wonderful. I really belong over there now. I just am so close to the people there.
How long have you been there, Cheryl?
I'm going on 7 years.
And as you come home, what, about once a year?
Yeah, something like that.
Well, I think, of course, what you're doing, I think, is important. And how could people would like to donate to help you in doing what you're doing? What would they do? How would they go about doing that?
Well, the donations normally go to a church here in Avila.
Well, could you want to get the name of the church out there?
Yeah.
Don't be bashful at all. There's one reason I wanted to put you on, was so that you possibly might be able to raise some support for what you're doing.
Yeah, normally what I do, because I'm a missionary, I get missionary support, and the support has been over what I need, and then I give to the people, and it's just really been a blessing. The Lord has blessed me these 7 years, and bless the people there through the support. But the address and the church is Avila Beach Calvary Chapel, P.O. Box 127, Avila Beach, 93424. That's California.
How do you spell Avila?
A, V as in Victor, I-L-A.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and that's Avila Beach Baptist Church, is it?
No, it's Calvary Chapel.
Calvary Chapel.
Yeah, and the best way to do that is the ministry is called Love Without Borders.
Mm-hmm.
That's the ministry I'm working under, and Smiley and I started this ministry, and now I'm handing it over to him because I want it to be run by locals, but I'm still part of the ministry, Love Without Borders.
All right, and of course, Smiley is a Palestinian?
Yes, he's a Palestinian, and he's an on-fire believer.
Yeah. And how long has he been living in the Israeli part of the country?
He's been there since 2002.
All right, so he's really been an old-timer. Now, was he himself a collaborator?
No, he wasn't a collaborator. He became a believer, and they called him a traitor. They put a fatwa in the paper, which means that he was legal to kill. They put that in the paper if you're a traitor, if you're a collaborator, or you change your religion from Islam. And so they had this death sentence on him, and they had him in the prison, and they were going to kill him. And the Israeli troops freed him and saved him. Well, God saved him, ultimately.
Well, I'm sure God has a purpose for each and every individual, and sometimes it's sort of hard to figure out what it is. But obviously, he freed Smiley so he could help you with your ministry, and of course he's kept you safe. But many times, aren't you in very, very perilous situations, certainly, especially when you're going into the Palestinian areas?
Yes. Well, Smiley and I, we go to the hideouts where these guys sometimes have to go and abandon warehouses and different places.
Now, are these in Israel or are these in Palestine, Palestinian area?
Different areas. Yeah, sometimes we go into the West Bank. Not too often with Smiley because he usually can't get out if we go into the West Bank. So I have to go in with other people or myself. And with him, I will go to hiding places in Israel proper in small towns or villages. And the guys, after we've left a couple places, the people have been beat up and put in the hospital. And so it's not a safe. I mean, our knees have knocked before. We looked at each other like, uh-oh, we've gone too far this time. So we ran quick, and you know, the thing is, we look at eternal life, and that is the most important thing. And if we're taking the gospel to somebody, you know, what's more important? You know, your life here or their life, their eternal life. So you go in, you pray, and you try not to be stupid about it.
Well, now, as far as the hiding places there in Israel, is this because the Palestinians really have no other place to go, or are they afraid that the authorities will come after them, or the Jews will come after them? I mean, who are they really hiding from?
No, they're hiding. A lot of them are hiding from Hamas because they've been collaborators. They're traitors.
I mean, that was, what do you mean? Hamas would come into the Israeli area to get them?
Oh, of course. Yes, they send thugs in from the PA, from Hamas. My friend's car was firebombed at 1 o'clock in the morning by one of them. Yes, they come in after them and they try to kill them. And so a lot of them do get killed. So you try to reach them before that happens. And you try to not, you know, to have a meeting, like a Bible study, is very hard because you have to not tell too many people where you're at. You have to keep moving it around. Otherwise, it could get firebombed.
In Israel itself, if you had a Bible study, you could get firebombed?
Yes.
Well, now, what about, would you have protection from the Israeli authorities? Wouldn't they try to object to that, or is that they really aren't able to control the Hamas operators?
Oh, it would be like here. If you were having a Bible study here and some gang member came by and shot in the building, you know, I mean, it's hard for the police to stop it as it's going on. So these people from Hamas, these people from the PA, maybe their cousins or uncles that called their relative a traitor, and they go in to kill them to make the family name right. You know, you have all these different scenarios, and you have spies among these collaborators. They send in people that say they're a collaborator, and they get all the names and find out who they are, where they live, and they send people in after them.
And you mean your relatives will actually kill you? By killing you, then you certainly clear the name of the family.
Right.
What sort of rationale is that?
There is no rationale in the Eastern mindset. I've been there 7 years, and I'm learning so much. But their mind is not quite like a Western mindset.
And what you're basically saying is then that they don't value human life at all.
In a certain sense, yeah. Well, if they can send a child in to be a suicide bomber, you know, it's just their mindset is completely different. One kid, the PA approached the child and said, because your father was a collaborator, you need to go blow up an Israeli patrol. So they gave the kid some dynamite or an explosive, put it in his hand. he walked up to the Israeli patrol, and the explosive went off on him before he could blow up the Israeli patrol. So it blew off his hand and paralyzed him. This is what happens to the people over there, and their mindset is so different from ours. It's hard. It's actually hard for me to work with these people. I had a very bad past. I did jail time in my past. I was a heroin addict in my past, and I knew a lot of street people, which actually helps me over in Israel working with the people I do, because I have a different approach.
And what way? You mean because you understand the sort of depraved mind, or what?
I understand the people a little bit more. When I was sitting around the table with a lot of the collaborators, and they were they didn't know me. They were laughing at me. I'm this little blonde gal from California. And they thought, who is this? And I got to give my testimony of how I was in jail and what I did, and I stole a truck, and I did this. And they looked at me, they said, you're one of us. It was my end.
All right, fine. Well, you hang on. We've got about 3 minutes more. If anybody would like to give us a call, the number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Cheryl Hancock, and we'll be back in just a moment. And she's over there in Israel doing what I wish I could do, but... Well, she can probably get away with it because she's a little blonde girl and I'm a great big heavy old guy, so she's probably not quite as conspicuous as I would be. Well, Cheryl, we got about 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program for us. What message would you like to leave with our listeners tonight and across America?
Well, I would just like to ask people for prayer, whoever's listening, especially for these guys that are going to be going maybe back to the West Bank. These guys have become believers in the meantime, lots of them. And if they go back to the West Bank, they need to stand for their faith, and they need to tell other people about their faith. And so we really need prayer for their protection, and we need prayer that the families are reunited. Most of the people don't have their families with them. We need prayer for the Messianic Jews that are coming out of the closet and telling other Jewish people about the Lord. There's a big movement of God over there going on now. The Lord is just doing mighty things, and there's not enough people to go and talk to people about the Lord now. All the people that want to hear, I can go 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and not have enough time to hit every house and talk to every person that wants to hear about the Lord.
Well, that's really exciting to know that really these things are happening, and this has never happened before in Israel, has it, this much interest in Christianity?
No, it hasn't. As a matter of fact, in Jericho, it's crazy. This gal's over there with her son living in a refugee camp, and she's baptizing them by the tens. I mean, they keep coming, and they want to be baptized, and they want to learn about the Lord. It's a phenomenon that's going on now, and so we know that it's the latter days, and it's getting closer.
Well, now, of course, they opened up any of those refugee camps. I remember when we were in Jericho, and up north of there, that all these refugee camps, you know, miles and miles of them just sitting there, that they were left over from the 1948 war. Are some of those inhabited today by refugees?
Yeah, people are living in them because, you know, a lot of people are very poor in Israel, and they have no place else to live. So Karen, this one gal, decided she would live right there among them, and that way she could reach them better. And she gives them bags of rice with scripture about the Lord and how Jesus loves them.
And, of course, now, she is a Christian, I assume, and she is an American or what?
Yeah, she is, yeah.
And she's just living there among the Palestinian refugees. People have to see these refugee camps. They're pretty dismal looking.
Oh, they're very bad. Her son said, we're going to have to move out of here. I can't stay in this. And then he decided he wanted to move back because of the work that's going on and the lives that are being changed. She's got favor with the authorities over there, both Palestinian authorities and the Israeli authorities. So it just takes a prodding of the Lord. You go, you do what the Lord tells you to do, and you walk out in faith, and you watch him, because he will do it. He is faithful.
Well, Cheryl, we appreciate so much your being with us, and we look forward to having you on our other programs. And I just wish I could be there with you, but since I can't, why, of course, you've got our proxy. God bless you for what you're doing.
Okay, and you're invited any time to come visit.
Good night, and God bless.
God bless you both.
Bye-bye. Okay, well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our interview with Cheryl Hancock, who's right on the front lines of this battle, of course, risking her life on a daily basis. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and if you're out there listening to us across America, we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day, reaching out on certainly on radio and on the internet and on shortwave and on satellite. And of course now we have our own satellite that's up there, and we're on that 9 hours a day. Joyce Riley's on it 9 hours a day, and then there are two other friends, Chris Meyer and Butch Paul, are on it each 3 hours a day. So you can listen to a good Christian programming 24 hours a day until Star 5. And if you're interested in knowing more about it, give us a call. And what we need to do is to counter people like Howard Stern, who's going to be broadcasting his filth and obscenity all over America, you know, 2 or 3 hours every day. Well, we want to offer you Christian programming on satellite every day, and it's available to you now. If you want more information, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we hope many of you will understand what is going on over in Israel. Israel doesn't make any sense. Unless you understand that our government is funding the terrorists. We've always funded the terrorists. In fact, Hamas was actually created by the Israeli government at the behest of the American government. When the PLO was about to be exterminated in the 1980s under the Reagan administration, who rescued the Palestinian Liberation Army? The American government, and sent them off to Tunisia and rearmed them, and so they could come back to continue the terrorist war. This is all being engineered. Nothing is as it appears to be. And when you begin to understand that, when you begin to understand we're financing the PLO, that's financing the payment of bounties to the insurgents' families after the insurgents have blown themselves up, killing American troops, and you ask yourself why? Well, because if we weren't funding the terrorists, there would not be this whole Islamic terrorist movement. And you can trace it back to the Freemasons, and we'll be giving you that story in the very near future. A wonderful book. We'll be interviewing the author called The Devil's Game. And it really all started back about the time when Cecil Rhodes was establishing his secret society in England. So there was a secret society being formed in the Holy Land by a man named Afghani. And he was basically a Freemason who was working in conjunction with British intelligence, and he was the forerunner to the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the forerunner to the modern Islamic terrorist movement. And as far as Al Jazeera, it's up on an American satellite being broadcast. It's hate literature into the United States. Why is our government allowing that? Well, I'll tell you why they're allowing it. Because if we didn't have an enemy, how would we have a war on terrorism? And until you begin to understand nothing as it appears to be, well, you're not going to be able to understand what's going on. So we ask you to go to our website of RadioLiberty.com if you'd like a copy of our latest newsletter called Deja Vu in Iraq. It goes into the real understanding of what's going on in Iraq today, which is being used as a distraction to keep us from seeing what's going on at home. And as our boys go overseas to fight for freedom, we're losing our freedom here in the United States. So we ask you, of course, to remember our number, 1-800-544-8927, our website, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until we're together again, may the Lord be with you.